And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. The gap between the haves and the have-nots has hit critical mass in America, and the nation's future hangs in the balance. That is the premise of a new book by Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz. In The Price of Inequality, Stiglitz argues that America's market system is broken and that the role of politics in our economic woes cannot be underestimated. In addition to winning the Nobel Prize in Economics, Professor Stiglitz is the author of a number of best-selling books, including Free Fall. He chaired the Council of Economic Advisors under President Bill Clinton, and he currently teaches at Columbia University. He is our guest today. Professor Stiglitz, welcome to Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
Well, thanks again. We want to know first how you are defining inequality. For the purposes of our conversation, what does that mean?
Well, actually, there are many aspects of inequality. Three of them, I think, stand out. What fraction of the entire income or wealth go to those at the top? A second concern is what's happening to the middle, the hollowing out of the middle. And finally, what's happening to the bottom, the fact that it's getting poorer and there are more people in poverty.
Yeah. Give us a scope of what that looks like in America right now.
Well, beginning on the top, the upper 1% gets around 20% of all the income. That's about twice what it was just 30 years ago. So inequality's been growing very rapidly. The upper 0.1% gets 3 to 4 times what it got 30 years ago. Looking at the middle, the point is that those at the top often say, oh, don't worry about what's happening at the top. That's just the politics of envy. Everybody benefits from the trickle-down, the fact that money given at the top benefits everybody in society. But that's not what's been happening in America. The people in the middle, we call the median income, half above, half below, has been falling. And today it's roughly at the level that it was a decade and a half ago. And then finally, in the bottom, there are more people in poverty, and we all know the kind of suffering that especially goes on in a period of recession where not only is the unemployment rate going up, but public services for those who are in need are cut back.
So there's always been inequality, but why has it become such a big factor in the health of our economy now? I mean, you certainly mentioned that the gap is growing, for one thing, but why is it so significant right now?
Well, it has been growing, and there's one more dimension that I think is a particular worrisome for America, and that is we always think of ourselves as a land of opportunity, equal opportunity, Horatio Alger stories of people who made it from the bottom to the top. But in fact, the United States has become the advanced industrial country with the most inequality and the least opportunity. That means the prospects of a young person in the United States are more dependent on the income and education of his parents than in any of the other advanced countries for which there's data.
Wow. How long, when did that number, was that number released?
Well, these numbers have been, you know, it's not just one study, it's a accumulation of studies, both in the United States and other countries. And as the data, you know, as study after study, the picture now is pretty clear that we have no, this idea of America as a land of opportunity is a myth.
Yeah, so the American dream is not what it was once cracked up to be, it sounds
like.
That's
right, and actually was in some sense. But the difference between the United States and say, the Scandinavian countries today is just very dramatic. They have been able to succeed in maintaining a high degree of equality of opportunity and a low level of inequality. And that's really one of the important points I make in the book. It's not just market forces. A lot of people say, oh, you know, this is just the outcome of market forces. But market forces are at play in all the advanced countries, the same forces, basically. But the way they play out is markedly different. And they're playing out in ways that are leading America to be exceptional. exceptionally unequal, exceptionally low in opportunity.
Yeah, exceptional for all the wrong reasons, it would seem.
Exactly.
How have the Scandinavian countries done that? How have they managed to keep a better balance of things?
Well, there are many. It's not just one thing. Part of it is, of course, important part is education, making sure that there's access to opportunity of education for all. Another thing they have is progressive taxes and good support for families. They believe that everybody ought to be able to participate in the labor force, and that means that you may need to help some people more than others. So it's actually a fairly comprehensive program. The interesting thing is that they've been able to grow faster than the United States, and they weathered the economic downturn better than the United States. So this idea that, well, inequality, yes, may be a bad thing, but to do anything about it would weaken our economy is just wrong. The fact is that the economies like those in Scandinavia that have done the most to maintain equality of opportunity and reduce inequality have actually been doing better.
Mm. But there has to be a degree of inequality in a capitalist society, right? I mean, you
That's
talk
right.
about the job creators sort of getting a larger piece of the pie or being rewarded more.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the issue isn't whether one ought to have some inequality. There has to be. You have to have incentives. But the problem is that much of our inequality is destructive, and it's what I refer to as rank-seeking. And the distinction is between those whose economic activities are directed at increasing the size of the national pie and those whose activities are directed at getting a larger share of the existing national pie. And unfortunately, many of those at the top have gotten their income through rank-seeking activity. And examples are, you know, the banks that engaged in predatory lending. That didn't make our economy more efficient. In fact, it brought on the crisis. And so their contribution to society was negative, and they walked off with huge incomes.
Hmm. And so you're saying that that whole idea of rent-seeking is really such a huge part of the problem, because it's not about increasing the pie, it's just increasing my slice of the pie, basically.
That's right.
Yeah.
And taking such a larger slice of the pie that everybody else gets a smaller slice of the pie, and in the efforts to get a larger slice of the pie, they actually make the whole pie smaller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the timing of your book, Professor, the fact that it's being released just weeks before the presidential election. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, this is a major issue in this election. Our country is being given a choice between two different directions. Romney does represent the kind of rank-seeking activity that I talk about. You know, these are not job creators. Actually, in many ways, they're often job destroyers. The special provisions in the tax code that he took advantage of, not there by accident, they're by stint of politics, of the 1% persuading Congress or buying Congress to pass these special provisions that actually weaken our economy. You know, if you tax speculators at less than half the rate that you tax people who work for their living, you're going to get more people engaged in speculation and less activity trying to actually make a stronger economy. So, in a way, this election is emblematic of the issues that I'm talking about.
Yeah, and that really is the crux of the issue, isn't it? This whole debate about, you know, do we tax the wealthiest people more heavily or not? And it seems that there just hasn't been the political will to make changes to that.
That's right. And it's not even, when you say tax them more heavily, not tax them more heavily even than the average Americans. The fact is they're being taxed less heavily, and Warren Buffett has made that point amply clear. He says it's wrong for him to pay a lower tax rate than his secretary. He should pay at least the same rate, and most people would think progressive taxation would say that he should pay a higher rate because he's clearly more able to afford it. Mm. And, you know, Warren Buffett has said that, but unfortunately, Mitt Romney has not come out and said, you know, I've taken advantage of the tax code, but I think there's something deeply disturbing about a tax code that allows me to pay so little taxes by using advantage of all kinds of loopholes.
Yeah. With that in mind, what are you anticipating from the candidates in Wednesday night's debate?
Well, I think this probably will be one of the issues. Clearly, one of the issues is going to be the state of the economy. And Mitt Romney will almost surely try to say the economy is weak, and the president will clearly point out that it's much better than the free fall that the economy that he inherited from President Bush, and that he will try to say, explain that the policies that Romney is advocating are going back to the kinds of deregulation 1% policies that got us into the mess, and President Obama is going to say, yes, we may have made slower progress than he had hoped, but that was because the problems he inherited were much deeper than what was widely understood at the time.
And, Professor, I don't have to tell you that there has been a focus on the Republican side about reducing the deficit, and that's been one of the big arguments. Listen, we need to focus on our deficit. We've got to get out of debt. What do you say about that? I imagine that will come up in the debate as well, and the concern about really focusing on that as opposed to focusing on some of these other things.
Well, first, let me say the major problem of our country right now is not the deficit. It's the fact that our economic performance is subpar. As a result of the recession that began in 2008. But if you're going to debate about the deficit, the best way to think about it is to go back just to the beginning, you know, 2001, when at the end of the Clinton administration, we had a surplus of about 2% of GDP. A natural question then to ask is, how do we go from that surplus to the current deficit situation? And there were three things that happened that Republicans engineered. The first was really in line with our discussion of inequality. We had a tax cut, the benefits of which went disproportionately to the rich. The second thing is we fought two very expensive wars costing trillions of dollars and expanded military even beyond that. Spending hundreds of billions of dollars on weapons that don't work against enemies that don't exist.
Professor, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought on the second one and tell us the third issue when we come back from a break, and we'll also take calls from our listeners. We have lots to talk about as we discuss the new book, The Price of Inequality. We'll be talking about that when Radio Times comes right back.
The National Multiple Sclerosis Society proudly supports WHYY. I'm Tammy Caesar, president of the Society's local chapter. We recently asked people in our area what MS means to them. We heard that MS means making the most of every day, that MS means setting new goals, and most of all, that MS means never giving up. People living with MS have hope that one day there will be a world free of MS. To find out how you can help or tell us your story, at msmeans.org.
I'm Mike and Scott. Listener support is vital to WHYY, and we'll be asking for yours during our upcoming membership campaign. But the October buyback is your chance to help give us a head start. Make a pledge during our October buyback, and for every 750 donations we receive, you'll buy back one day. This means one less day of pledge and one more day of news without membership breaks. Do your part at whyy.org/support. Thank you.
There's one issue that's dominated the race between President Barack Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney.
We don't build the economy from the top down. We build it from the bottom up.
Let's get America working again.
Tomorrow night, the candidates will debate the economy and other domestic issues. I'm Guy Raz. Join us for special coverage of the first presidential debate from NPR News.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about the price of inequality, how today's divided society endangers our future, and that is the title of a new book by Joseph Stiglitz, who happens to be the winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. And we've been talking about the growing gap between the haves and the have-nots in America, and the premise of the book is that growing gap threatens the very future of our nation. And Professor, when we left off, you were talking about how we went from having a surplus at the end of the Clinton administration to having a huge deficit now. And you said that there were three things that have happened in the time since then. One was a tax cut that seemed to disproportionately benefit the wealthiest Americans. You talked about two very, very expensive wars, and we left off there. So I want you to finish that thought, if you would. And then the third thing that's changed since 2001.
Two other things, actually. Well, one of them is we passed an important drug benefit as part of Medicare, but there was one little sentence that was put in the bill that said that the U.S. government, the largest buyer of drugs, could not bargain with the drug industry. And the result of that is a gift to the drug industry estimated to be about $500 billion over 10 years. And then the final thing is the recession itself. And this is really the most important thing to remember. The recession, the downturn, is the major cause of our deficit, not the other way around. So if we recover the economy, put America back to work, it would do more for reducing our deficit than anything else. And the policies that are advocated by many of the Republicans of austerity will actually weaken the economy, and the improvements in the deficit will be disappointing. And this is an experiment, you might call it. This experiment of austerity has been tried over and over again. You know, Herbert Hoover did it back in 29, converted the stock market crash into the Great Depression. IMF tried this in East Asia and Argentina, converted downturns and recessions into depressions. And now the European countries have tried it. And austerity has again not only produced recessions. In the case of Spain and in the case of Greece, they produced a depression.
And a lot of protesting as well, a lot of problems there around that. Let me go to the phones. We have lots more to talk about, but let me go to the phones, and we'll start off in Franklin County with John. Welcome, John, to Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask Dr. Stiglitz, is one of the ways some people talk about helping with reduced income inequality is to try and return high-paying manufacturing jobs to the United States like we experienced during the Internet asset bubble in the late 90s when we did see middle incomes rise. And I wanted to know if you see any way that that could happen without significantly revamping perhaps labor legislation, maybe even giving employees seats on corporate boards. And more importantly, and secondly, could it happen while we still embrace free trade laws without, you know, say, unless we, I mean, my personal opinion is we'll never see those jobs again unless we return to bilateral trade.
Well, you raise a lot of interesting issues. The first is we have to remember that we are a victim of our own success. Increases in productivity in manufacturing are so great that employment, they've exceeded the pace of expansion of demand. And this is a global phenomenon, not just American phenomena. And so it is not likely that manufacturing will be the basis of our economy going forward. Still, it's going to be important, but it's going to be of declining importance. The second point, you mentioned high-paying jobs. We ought to note that a lot of the jobs in manufacturing that we've been saving, so-called, have not been high-paying jobs. They've been actually much lower-paying jobs than the old manufacturing jobs. The third point I guess I make is you're absolutely right. We need reforms in our corporate governance. I think we need to have more say for stakeholders. The fact that the CEOs were able to walk off with so much of the income, the revenues of the firm, undermining investment, undermining wages, really speaks a lot. It's part of one of the sources of our inequality, and they've taken advantage of deficiencies in our corporate governance laws. We really have to do something about that. And finally, I agree very strongly that we need a more active role for government to promote the restructuring of our economy. We're going to be moving from a manufacturing-based economy to a more service-based economy, just like 75 years ago, we moved from an agriculture economy to a manufacturing economy. And markets don't do this kind of structural transformation very well. So my hope is that with the appropriate kinds of government assistance, we can make that more successfully than we've been doing.
Well, thank you so much, John, for your call. And let me give the number for our listeners who'd like to join in our conversation. It's 888-477-9499. You're listening to WHYY, and we're talking about the price of inequality, how today's divided society endangers our future. The author of that book is a winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, Professor Joseph Stiglitz, and we've been talking about this growing gap between the haves and the have-nots and what is ahead for our country. Professor, talk about tax cuts, because you mentioned that as one of the things that really sort of threw us out of whack in the last 10 or 11 years. The two-year extension on the Bush tax cuts is about to expire. Do you think that they should be extended again? What should happen at this point?
No, I don't. I mean, let me put it like this. What I feel quite firmly about is that extending the tax cuts for the millionaires or the people at the top doesn't make any sense. It would be far better to raise taxes on that group and either use that money for deficit reduction or use it for, even better, for investments in our future. If you raise taxes and spend the money, it turns out that it stimulates the economy quite a bit, particularly if you raise the taxes on the top and you spend it on investments in the country that strengthen your long-term prospects, it can have a very powerful short-run and long-run effect.
Yeah. And you have pointed out that tax cuts often don't have the desired effect, which many people think they will have, which is to stimulate the economy.
That's right. I mean, it's interesting that the strongest boom the economy has had for a long time was under President Clinton in the mid-90s, and that was after an increase of taxes on the very top. So this idea that taxes weaken the economy, you know, obviously if you had 100, it's just wrong. If you had excessively high taxes, that would be a problem. But we're nowhere near that level. You know, when I go to Europe and I talk to people about the level of taxes at the top in our debate about increasing taxes at the very top by millionaires from 36 to 39.6, they laugh and they say, you know, of course they should pay more than that.
Well, to what degree would raising taxes on the wealthiest Americans improve our economy? If that were to be implemented, what would the net effect be, do you think?
Well, part of the reason that those at the very top pay so little taxes is because they take advantage of the special treatment that we give to capital gains, mm-hmm. and that we tax speculators at a lower rate than those who really are contributing to our economy. So if we got rid of some of these distortions that those at the top take advantage of, we would actually have a more productive economy, and of course we would have more tax revenues that we could then again invest inside the country on things that will strengthen our future.
If I read this right, Professor, it seems like I came across something that said that the Congressional Budget Office estimated not long ago that tax cuts, the Bush-era tax cuts, actually cost the Treasury something like $1.6 trillion?
At a minimum, that's right. The cost, this is over a 10-year period, but as our economy grows, that cost gets larger and larger. And so those tax cuts were a major source of our deficits. And that's why I said it's a very, if you're thinking about the problem of deficits, why not go back to the world that we had growing very strongly in the 90s, where we had a surplus? How do we go from that surplus to the deficits? And let's reverse those things. And if we do that, of course, we'll do a lot to get rid of the deficit.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. The number is 888-477-9499 if you'd like to join in our conversation about our economy and about the gap between the wealthiest Americans and the poorest Americans and how that gap is growing. We're going to go to Marlton, New Jersey, and bring Chuck into our conversation. Hi, Chuck. Welcome to Radio Times.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to ask the professor to comment on, I hear a term being resurrected now, supply side economics, which they used to talk about back in the Reagan time with the trickle down theory. I wonder if he could comment on the pros and cons of that.
Well, I think supply side economics has been totally discredited. It was an idea that President Reagan first broached, and the idea was that if you lower tax rates, you get such a large response in increase in labor supply and savings and growth that tax revenues actually go up. But, of course, we know what happened after he lowered the tax rate. We had our largest deficits ever up to that point. And we know what happened after Bush lowered his taxes. We had even larger deficits. So supply-side economics has not worked. And the other idea you talked about is trickle-down economics. And that says, if you give enough money to people at the top, everybody benefits. And what's been happening in the United States shows quite the contrary, that, in fact, while the wealthy have been doing very, very well, those in the middle have been doing very poorly. Incomes in the middle are back to where they were more than a decade and a half ago. Wealth in the middle is back to where it was almost two decades ago. So the fact is that these ideas have been, by now, thoroughly discredited.
Mm. Professor, it seems, too, that sort of presupposition that giving more money to the wealthiest, giving access to more money, has been a good thing, and that does, as you mentioned, trickle down, and yet from what I understand, the statistics show that the wealthiest people are not so much spenders necessarily as they are savers.
That's right. They save about 15% to 20% of their income. It's actually one of the explanations that the IMF and the UN have called attention to as one of the underlying sources of the crisis. What happened as we had more inequality, more money was going to the top, demand would have gone down except for the exceptional actions that the Fed took, which was very low interest rates and deregulation, which created a bubble, the result of which was those at the bottom were actually spending, the bottom 80% of Americans were spending about 110% of their income.
Hmm.
That wasn't sustainable. We created an unstable situation. And part of our problem today is that we've maintained a high level of inequality. It's actually gotten worse because as the recession goes on, unemployment persists, wages get driven down, and the result of that is, of course, that total demand is weaker than it otherwise would be.
There certainly has been a lot of talk about the stimulus throughout this presidential campaign and whether it was the right thing to do or not. President Obama has taken a lot of heat for implementing that stimulus, at least on one side of the aisle. Was he right to do it that way?
Well, I think that among all serious economists, it's clear that the stimulus worked. Where President Obama and his economic team made a mistake was they were overly optimistic about the state of the economy. They thought the unemployment rate was going to peak around 10% and that the stimulus would bring it down by about 2.5%, down to about 7.5%. But the downturn, that he inherited was much worse. And without the stimulus, unemployment would have peaked around 12.5%, 13%. In fact, it peaked around 10%. So it did work. Much lower stimulus, much lower unemployment than it otherwise would have been. But it was not large enough, it was not long enough, and it was not as well designed as it could have been. The tax cut for those at the top was not the best way of spending money. It would have been far better to give aid to the states to help fill in their budgets. Their revenues were going down. As the revenues were going down, they were firing teachers, weakening our economy, weakening our investments in our future. And that would have been a far better way of spending the money.
Another issue that the president has taken heat for is spending so much energy and political capital on health care reform, particularly given the sickness of the economy. Do you think he was right in doing that? And is there a connection between those things, the health care reform and the state of our economy?
Well, there's a political judgment call about whether fighting for that distracted attention from other issues. But in terms of the economics, and particularly the issues that I'm concerned about, inequality, what's astounding about the United States is the inequality in access to health care, which, you know, I said before, we are the country with the most inequality of the advanced industrial countries. But in terms of access to health care, we're even worse. The gap between us and other countries, other advanced countries, is even greater. The most recent data that's come out is really disturbing, that life expectancy among the bottom has gone down about 5 years. And, you know, that's numbers that are reminiscent of what happened in Russia in the years after the fall of the Iron Curtain. So, you know, what is going on in the United States is deeply disturbing in terms of health care, and as both a moral issue and as an economic issue, it's important to extend access to health care. If you don't provide adequate health care, say, for children, they risk being scarred for life and less productive members of our society, not able to make a contribution, and that weakens the economy.
We've got less than 60 seconds before the break, but I'm wondering if, in the end, does the political will exist, particularly given the Congress that we have right now, to make the kinds of changes necessary to shrink that gap?
I'm not sure, and particularly if Congress stays roughly where it is today, it's going to be very hard to move. But there are a lot of issues on which there's broad consensus. Doing something about the financial sector, which is one of the major sources of inequality, doing something about monopolies. Both people on the left and right agree that monopolies, which are a source of a lot of inequality, undermine the efficiency of the economy.
Well, we'll stop right there, but we have much more to talk about when Radio Times comes back. We're talking about the book, The Price of Inequality. The author is Joseph Stiglitz, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. Radio Times will be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at ibx.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Thomas Anderson talks about writing and directing his new film, The Master, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman as the leader of a cult group in 1950 and Joaquin Phoenix as a troubled World War II vet who makes his way into the group. Anderson also directed Boogie Nights and There Will Be Blood. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A reporter just back from Afghanistan describes the mood there. He says surprisingly troops want more engagement with Afghans despite the insider attacks. Also, how much are you paying to stay connected? Is your cell phone eating up your budget? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
And you are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and we are talking about the economy, isn't everyone? We're talking specifically about a new book called The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future. The book is written by Joseph Stiglitz, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. He also is the author of a number of best-selling books, including Free Fall. He teaches at Columbia University, and he has been helping us understand how the inequality, the income gap in America is affecting our country and is likely to affect our country going forward. We'll go to the phones. The number is 888-477-9499 if you'd like to join in our conversation. We'll start off in Chestnut Hill and bring Paul into our chat. Paul, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask about the people who are advancing arguments for austerity. Like, whose interests are they representing, and to what extent is there a valid argument? So, like, in other words, if a lot of people would say you need to spend your way out of a recession, to what extent do you have to be concerned about spending too much? And in Europe, where they're so worried about, just letting these countries off the hook that have spent too much and, reining in social programs, to what extent is that a valid concern, and who really benefits from that? So thank you for taking my question.
Thanks, Paul.
Sure. The countries like Greece have very little choice. They can't raise money on the capital markets, and their economic policy is being dictated by Germany, the Troika. And unfortunately, the policies that they are demanding of Greece and Spain and the other countries is this austerity. And we now have ample evidence that it's not working. It's actually led to a depression, 25% unemployment in Spain, 50% youth unemployment, no sense of any light at the end of the tunnel, and real political turmoil is being engendered. The United States is in a totally different position. We can borrow right now from the markets at a negative real interest rate. That is to say, taking into account inflation, we can borrow at a negative real interest rate, and we have ample projects that we can undertake, investments in education, infrastructure, technology, that yield extraordinarily high real returns. And so it's really foolish for us not to be borrowing to make those investments. And at the same time, that spending will lead to more employment and more growth, and that will give more revenues, and in the medium to long term, our deficits will be reduced. Now, there is a point that countries over the longer term have to have some sense of proportions. They have to, you might say, be fiscally responsible. And that's why in the Clinton administration, when growth was strong, we had a surplus. And the really sad news was the fact that Bush inherited that strong growth, in the period after 2003, when the economy started to grow again, rather than having the kind of surplus that marked the Clinton administration, we had deficits. So periods of strong growth are times when you should structure your tax and expenditure policies to have a surplus. Periods of weak demand, such as now, are periods where you ought to have a deficit. And if you can spend that money in ways that lead to long-term economic growth, so much the better.
Hmm. We'll go next to University City and Yaniv. Welcome, Yaniv.
Hi, it's a great show. My question is, some economists, and Stephen Keen is among them, pointed to private sector debt and specifically to household debt levels, whether it be from mortgage or credit card or college loan or what have you, as the driver of the economic malaise. And they say that things can't improve until the leveraging of much of that debt takes place. And I was wondering if Professor Stiglitz buys that theory. And also, does he see income inequality playing into that, contributing to the accumulation of debt in the economy?
Yeah, income inequality has played a important role in leading to, there's a close link between that and the deadness of the private sector. You know, people inevitably are looking around at their neighbors, their spending patterns, and that leads them to higher levels of spending than they otherwise would have. And, of course, the mismanagement by the financial sector, the 1%, has also had a disastrous effect because they helped create this bubble, and then when it broke, it was ordinary Americans who lost the most, who saw their wealth go down, but their burden of the debt remained. The theory, though, that the problem is just one of deleveraging, I think, is not quite correct. Deleveraging is necessary, but it's not going to be sufficient. The reason why I say that is that before the crisis, we had a savings rate of zero, or close to zero. It's now 4 or 5%. Historical average is 7%, and that's a number that would be appropriate for, you might say, a normal economy, and with an aging economy, a number might even be larger. So the idea that we would hope to have a savings rate go down as a result of deleveraging, I think, is not something that it should be a concern, because that would mean that we were over-consuming. So deleveraging is going to be an important part of restructuring our economy going forward. But even after we do the deleveraging, our economy is going to remain weak.
We'll go next to Leah, calling from West Philly. Leah, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is a great conversation. I was wondering, I know we're in election season right now, and I think that one of the reasons that an austerity approach appeals to voters is because that's the way that you would handle a household financial crisis. If you're in debt, you'd cut back on expenses, you start paying off your debt little by little, maybe, you know, get an extra job. But I'm wondering if the guest could talk about why a national economy kind of functions fundamentally differently, and I hear you talking about, you know, spending your way out. So how to, for people who think about their finances in terms of their own situation and therefore think that, you know, austerity measures would be good for the country, why is that sort of not a good parallel to make?
That's a great question, and that analogy between the household and the government is one of the fallacies that has been propagated, especially on the right. It's something that we explained in the first couple weeks of an introductory course in principles of economics called the fallacy of composition. Basically, the idea is the following. If you cut back on your spending, it doesn't have any overall macroeconomic effect. It doesn't have any effect on the economy as a whole. But when the government cuts back, what we're talking about is very big effects on the overall level of total demand in the economy. And when that happens, of course, when demand goes down, output will go down, employment will go down, and when employment goes down, then, of course, you get into a vicious circle because then demand goes down even more. So your problems get even worse. As you cut back, unemployment goes up, as I said, and then tax revenue actually diminishes. So you think that you're addressing your problem, but you're not. And the clearest example of that was Argentina, where the IMF insisted on austerity, and they insisted and insisted until the economy broke down and they had a crisis, and then they broke out of the IMF strictures, and they started to grow at 8% from the period 2002 until the global financial crisis of 2008.
All right, we'll go next to Maniunk and Steve. Welcome, Steve, to Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm kind of at the core of this, and I got a nagging question, is what is wealth growth? I mean, now we seem to be focused so much on arbitrage, speculation, these bizarre instruments that, you know, that are created. But where is the wealth coming from? Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's a great question, too. One of the points that Paul Volcker, who was the former chairman of the Council of the Federal Reserve Board, pointed out is that all these financial instruments, all this financial activity, had not led to a better performing economy, had not led to more real wealth creation. What we mean by wealth, what we really mean, of course, is real investments, whether it's factories, machines, R&D, new technology. These are the things that are real wealth. And, of course, a well-functioning financial market is supposed to take people's savings and direct it into productive investments that lead to real increases in wealth. But unfortunately, our financial system didn't do that. It actually misallocated resources and created more risk and destabilized our economy. There's one more aspect of real wealth that I think sometimes gets neglected, and that's the real wealth of what we call human capital, investments in people, because that's probably the most important productive asset in our economy. And I mentioned a little bit earlier that America has become the country with the least equality of opportunity. And the reason for that is we are underinvesting in our people. And the investments in education that we make are more dependent on the income and education of a child's parents than in other countries. And so the result of this is that we are underutilizing our most important asset, our people.
We have time for one more question from our listeners. We'll go to Downingtown and Matt. Welcome, Matt, to Radio Times. Matt, can you hear us?
I can.
There we go. Hi.
My question for the professor is this. What theoretical benefit is there to an actual literal reduction in the size of the United States government as a means of strengthening the economy or reducing the debt, if you will?
The question is more the way we spend the money, not the overall size. I think it's very clear that we need to spend more on our investments in technology, on infrastructure, on education. We are underinvesting, and that's actually weakening our economy. And it costs us a lot. You know, not investing on those New Orleans levees cost us a couple $100 billion. We spent $5 billion, we would have saved an enormous amount of money. So not spending on these investments is actually weakening our economy. On the other hand, we're wasting a lot of money. No one can deny that. The drug benefit, that the fact that we are overpaying the drug companies, the fact that we're overpaying a lot of our military contractors, that money isn't strengthening our economy. Much of that isn't really contributing much to our real security. So, in my mind, the issue is not so much the size of our government, but we ought to redirect more of our money away from this corporate welfare. We spent $180 billion in a bailout of one company, AIG. if we redirected the money from these kinds of corporate welfare to productive investments, our economy would be much stronger. In the current economic slowdown, increasing the size of the economy, taxing the people at the upper 1%, spending the money on these productive investments, will have both benefits in the short run and in the long run. Mm-hmm.
Professor, in our last 60 seconds or so on our program, I'd like for you to tell us what one piece of advice would you give to the next president, whether it's Obama or Romney, about how to fix the economy? What's the most important thing they need to know in your view?
Well, the most important thing is that we need to stimulate the economy, and we need to address the problem of foreclosures, the property. Remember that it was the real estate bubble, the breaking of it, that actually instigated the economic downturn. And that relates then back to the problem of inequality. We threw a lot of money at the top, at the bankers and the banks. We didn't invest enough at the bottom in our ordinary homeowners, our workers, and a policy that increases equality and equality of opportunity will do more to strengthen the economy, both in the short run and the long run, than almost anything else. Hmm.
Professor Joseph Stiglitz, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times. It's been a pleasure talking with you. The book is called The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future. You've been listening to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. Our engineer is Kevin Griffin, and our producers are Patty McMahon, Susan Greenbaum, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder.